Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Barbara Miner is our guest this hour. Lessons from the Heartland is her book, a turbulent half-century of public education in an iconic American city, and the city happens to be Milwaukee. She's former managing editor of Rethinking Schools. She's been a reporter for the New York Times, the Milwaukee Journal, a writer and an editor for a number of years. She has co-edited many books on education, and she says, and I think this is true, when you look at the history of Milwaukee Public Schools, the past is never dead. It's not even past, William Faulkner. And I guess that's the case when you look at this issue. She's going to be on Friday, January 25, doing a book signing and talk. We'll tell you about that during the course of this hour. But we have much to talk about with Barbara. Looking at the segregation in Milwaukee schools, the segregation in metropolitan region of the country, the test scores, reading scores in particular, math scores and reading scores for minority students in the city, why are schools so segregated now? And the question that really is of interest to me is why this voucher movement started in the city of Milwaukee, why it has spread to the state, is it a national model, and what's going on with it? What's the ultimate goal? And it's been around enough years in this city to find out how's it going. Barbara is our guest. We'll be welcoming phone calls for her. Our phone number during this hour is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And just to state up front, as you who listen to me over the years know, I'm a strong proponent of public education. I'm a former high school teacher. And I'd like to start with you, Barbara, with this indictment in Milwaukee of public schools. It's something that has spread to the state and to the country in many ways, too. What's the origin of that? Why are we bashing public schools?
Well, I think part of what happened is a confluence of groups came together to promote vouchers in the early 1990s. And it's clear now, 20 years later, that it was basically a bait and switch. You know, it was promoted as helping poor black kids, but the people who were behind that voucher movement, the people who philosophically were behind it and financially behind it, didn't really believe in public education, and that is so clear. And there's a lot of reasons, but one big reason is we are the home here in Milwaukee of the Lyndon Harry Bradley Foundation, who over the years have been the most consistent financial backer of school vouchers. Ironically, interestingly, whatever adverb you want to use, the other big claim to fame of the Bradley Foundation is they funded the bell curve, which basically says blacks are incapable, genetically incapable, of being as intelligent as whites. So you have this very odd phenomenon, to say the least, of a movement that claimed it was in support of educating black kids, funded by a foundation that believed black kids weren't as smart. And so that's, again, where I think the bait and switch, because I believe, and I make no bones about it, I support public education. Public schools, host of problems, but that doesn't mean we abandon them. And we have abandoned them in Milwaukee, and it's only gotten worse.
What is the track record? You write in the book about studies that have shown that, because we've had enough years now to see whether or not voucher schools are better than public schools. And the findings aren't really terrific for voucher schools, are they?
Well, the easiest and clearest and most accurate answer is no. The voucher schools, I mean, it took 20 years because the voucher schools are defined as private and wanted to protect that privacy. It took 20 years to say, hey, folks, if you're going to get public money, at the very least, you got to take the same tests as the public school students. When they finally did, when you were comparing apples to apples in 2010, the voucher schools did worse than MPS. About the same in reading, significantly worse in math. And when you factored out the special education students, because the voucher schools do not have to provide the same services for special ed students, they were significantly worse. And so, and the reason it's important is this isn't a Milwaukee phenomenon. I mean, you know, understandably, people out of state might go, oh, Milwaukee, my gosh, it's, you know, it's its own beast, it's its own city. Why do I have to worry about what's going on in Milwaukee? Well, it's pretty clear vouchers are coming your way. I mean, if you didn't see that in 2011 when Walker proposed it, and then it's in Racine and they want to move it out to other cities, man, oh, man, it's coming. It's coming throughout the state. There's no doubt about it that that is the Walker agenda.
And there's also, who's the woman who's an heir, I think, to the Amway fortune that you write about?
Betsy DeVos.
Tell us about Betsy.
Well, Betsy basically is a Michigan, based in Michigan, the Amway Foundation, the Amway Family Money, probably best known as the sister of the guy who formed Blackwater, the mercenary group in Iraq. Huge Republican, long-standing Republican operative. I mean, at one point in, you know, about 10 years ago, she boasted that, you know, my family's given more money to the Republican National Party than any other family, and I'm proud of it. And, you know, again, one of the problems is there's a lot of money behind vouchers because there's a huge pot in public education. And if the voucher, you know, the vouchers is basically a way to take money out of public schools into private schools. And these voucher movement people, they, boy, they hire some really sophisticated PR people. But, you know, at a certain point, it's sort of like sometimes I look at the voucher movement claims and I feel like I'm reading the National Enquirer, you know, like, you know, these weight loss ads where they say, take this magic pill and lose 20 pounds in 20 days, you know, or swallow this magic voucher pill and your schools will be better tomorrow. And I look at it and I go, wow, do people really believe that?
So the goal, you're saying, is for this less than successful voucher program to become the way that all of our students are educated in this state?
Well, I think Milton Friedman, who is sort of the ideological godfather of the voucher movement, I guess the easiest way to look at it is to turn education sort of like food stamps, where everyone gets a certain amount, and you can take that school voucher food stamp, you know, thing, and some people will go to public schools because that's what they can afford. Some people will take that voucher and go to university school where the tuition might be three times higher, but they can supplement that with their own income. And what it means fundamentally is, as a democratic country, abandoning our constitutional commitment, because the right to a free and quality public education is written into the Wisconsin Constitution and every constitution in this country, because people believed so strongly that public education was integral to the society's future, to our children's future, and to our future as a democracy. And we abandon public education at risk to our very vision of our country.
So why hasn't this whole movement been challenged on a constitutional basis then?
Well, it has been challenged. And, you know, it's interesting because in different states there's been a stronger constitutional opposition to this. And it's interesting because what happened in the early 21st century, in early 2000, is it went to the Supreme Court. And the big issue there was the religious schools. You know, here in Milwaukee, when I tell people in New York that 85% of the kids receiving vouchers go to religious schools, they look at me and they go, no, that can't be true. No, that can't be. I go, yes, it is true. Because fundamentally, in addition to taking money out of public education into private schools, it's really about taking money out of public education into private religious schools. And there's a ruse, quite frankly, another bait and switch. I mean, the voucher movement's pretty good at bait and switch. So the argument is, well, we're not really giving the money to the school and to the religious school. We're giving it to the parent, and they're giving it to the religious school, which is, it's completely bogus on its face. But it was enough to sway the U.S. Supreme Court to say, well, you know, we have these failing schools. Let's give them this option.
What happened, as you well know and you document, there were a number of prominent African-American leaders in this city. Superintendent of Public Education, Howard Fuller, for one, Annette Polly Williams, for another, who really took on this voucher movement because they felt as though African-American students were getting the shaft. They had to be bused farther. Their schools were not as good. White kids could go to schools where it cost money to go, and they had a superb education. So a number of them became ardent supporters of vouchers. What's happened to African-American support for voucher schools? Are there still a number of supporters, and are their criticisms of public schools valid?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I don't think any more than you can say the white community believes. You can't really say the black community believes. There's a lot of disagreement in the black community. And I've been on Eric Vaughn and Earl Ingram and the WMCS radio stations, and a lot of callers very, very critical of vouchers, partly because, you know, after 20 years, people see what's really happening and not just the rhetoric. And I think the clearest example is Polly Williams. You know, she was initially called the mother of school choice.
Right.
And I interviewed Polly, you know, for the book and have, you know, talked to her over the years. And she will very clearly say, you know, we're this voucher movement now. This ain't nothing what I wanted it. She said, you know, in fact, in one interview with the USA Today, she said, you know, I wanted, you know, vouchers for black kids. They wanted, you know, the business community wanted it for their schools. And one of the things that's also very clear is that it's really, you know, this whole thing of it's for poor black kids, with the Walker expansion, that's out the door completely. There's not even really this sort of fig leaf of this is for poor black kids anymore. It's just like, well, you know, let's have choices. And again, it's seductive rhetoric, but what they're basically saying, when you look at, forget the rhetoric, look at what's happened in Milwaukee. I mean, Milwaukee, one of the clear lessons of the voucher movement is that it took money out of the public schools, it took students out of the public schools, but sent back to the public schools those kids it did not want to educate. It didn't do any better educating these kids. And so you have this sort of perfect storm of problems where at this point, there's a question whether the Milwaukee public schools will survive.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Public Policy Forum recently came out with a huge report. And, you know, the Public Policy Forum, and it's done in that polite, more sophisticated language, but it says Milwaukee needs a discussion on how MPS will survive.
What would happen instead, Barbara?
Well, well, one of the things that could very easily happen is you'll have about 10,000 kids going out to Mayfair Mall and Bayshore because they don't have any schools to go to. I mean, seriously, it's people are not, you want to go wake up and smell the coffee. We need to talk in this city. And we need to talk in the state, because what's happening in Milwaukee, I mean, we have 20 years experience, but this is a train that's traveling around the state.
You also write, though, that a number of the voucher students return to public schools.
Oh, a huge number return to the public schools for a lot of different reasons. Poor people move a lot. The voucher schools, because they're private schools, do not have to educate kids with the special ed. So as a result, you have 20% special education population in the Milwaukee public schools, a little bit less than 2% in the voucher schools. But, I mean, one of the ways to just look at the attrition over the voucher schools, because parents will choose them, but then they're also choosing to leave them because they're not serving their kids. I mean, they had a longitudinal study, fancy big word, longitudinal. But looking over time, the study, its very findings were called into question because so many kids left the voucher schools. After 5 years, less than 20% of those kids were still in the voucher schools.
How do you have a district, you write about this, and you're fairly honest about the strengths of Milwaukee Public Schools and the weaknesses of the schools, and you can't look at that without looking at what has happened to this city and other cities as well, but the city is incredibly, the area is incredibly segregated, which has an effect on education, much higher rate of poverty because of what's happened to the industrial base in the city of Milwaukee. A couple questions. How has the change, the economic change, influenced public schools? And is it important, well, if you're talking about the removal of a system at all, I don't know if we can talk about this, but is it important to return to some kind of system where you have a mix of wealthy students and not so wealthy students and poor students in schools?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things I often say is in diversity, there is strength. I mean, it's a classic lesson of evolution.
I believe that.
But I mean, everything, everywhere we look, you know, whether it's biology or
right,
in diversity is strength. And one of the lessons, because I go back to 1957, start the book with the World Series, Hank Aaron, great hero of Milwaukee. But one of the lessons is back in the 60s, people didn't really see oh, there's education, oh, there's jobs, oh, there's housing. They saw all of these issues as very much interrelated, that you couldn't talk about education without talking about housing, without talking about jobs, and without talking about segregation.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happened in this city is we've stopped having the discussions we need to have. And it's, education's complicated. Housing is complicated. Jobs are complicated. But we'll never solve these problems if we don't talk about them. I mean, what you mean, it's just sad to me that here we are in Milwaukee, and I remember my daughter, she's in law school right now, and about a year ago, she's sitting there in class, and the law professor says, "So, class, guess what's the most segregated city in the country?"
She knew the answer.
Oh, she's and she didn't raise her hand. She started slinking in her chair because she knew, and she was embarrassed. And you know, it's so bad that they've even had to coin a new term. Oh, my gosh. I go like, oh, crazy. But, you know, we're now called hypersegregated because the segregation is so deep and so pervasive. And this is, you know, it's not just bad for Milwaukee. It's bad for the state. I mean, it's bad for people to sort of be divided against each other. I mean, you know, I believe united we fall, united we, you know, we, you know, divided we fall, united we stand. And all we do is we just do all these decisions that further the divisions rather than trying to unite the area.
Let's welcome phone calls for you. And Barbara also wants to do some reading. She'll set that up for us a little later. Is that all right?
Perfect.
Barbara Miner is our guest. Barbara has been involved in education issues and writing about them for a long time. She's former managing editor of Rethinking Schools. She is author now of Lessons from the Heartland, A Turbulent Half-Century of Public Education in an Iconic American City. She's been a reporter for the New York Times, the Milwaukee Journal, and a writer and editor for a number of years. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. She, as she said, goes back to the 1950s when she talks about Milwaukee as a symbol of industrial power and a promised land of family-supporting jobs. Even in 1970, it's hard to think of this, black male employment rate was 85%, just a little lower than the white percentage. So what happened from the country's Milwaukee educational claim to fame became a school voucher programs? What happened in the intervening years, and what has happened to public education as a result of the voucher program, and what are the plans for the voucher program for the rest of the state, and what about the future of, I can't believe we're saying this, public education? We'll go to your phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Barbara Miner, and let's start with Ted in Janesville. Hi, Ted.
Hi. This is a very interesting program, and I'm not originally from Wisconsin. I'm from New York City, and I remember decades ago when the voucher program was rolled out in Milwaukee. It really made national news, and I remember one of the central arguments was that not only is it good just to offer more choice for that reason alone, but that the voucher program was going to create more competition that was going to put an upward pressure on the rest of the Milwaukee public school system and would benefit all schools. Mm-hmm. And decades later, I think that regardless of your partisan affiliation, I think there's probably agreement that this hasn't happened. How is it that this, despite the clear evidence to the contrary, that this argument can go forward and that this the vouchers can still have steam?
It's an interesting question.
Well, you know, and I ask that about a lot of things going on in politics in this country right now. And I think one of the things is there are private interests who see that pot of money in public education. There are other people who really don't believe in public education as an institution. I mean, many years ago, I spoke with, you know, Michael Joyce, head of the Bradley Foundation, and he said public schools are socialism. I mean, he just did not believe in public schools as an institution. And the other thing is also religious schools are looking for money. And, you know, I went to Catholic schools. My mother was Catholic. All my brothers and sisters went to Catholic schools. She strongly supported Catholic education. But she was very upset about the voucher movement. She said, how can we let our public schools die? That's just not right. And one of the concerns I have about money going to religious schools is people really don't understand that basically what we're saying is you can get public dollars, but you don't have to follow the same rules. And there's an interesting case out of La Crosse a couple of years ago where a woman, her name Wendy Ostlin, and she was a first grade teacher at St. Patrick's Elementary School near La Crosse, taught there for 28 years, and she was quote-unquote terminated. I mean, I guess I would say she was fired, but I guess terminated is the nice way of putting that. And she went to court, and she said this is age discrimination because when they fired her, they hired a 35-year-old teacher to take her place. And she went to court, and the circuit court, appeals court, agreed with her and said this is indeed age discrimination. Well, it gets up to the Supreme Court, and unfortunately, as we know, our Wisconsin Supreme Court is not necessarily a bastion of integrity these days. Anyhow, she gets up to the Supreme Court, and Michael Gableman, who wrote the opinion, himself the subject of several ethics complaints, he said, well, actually, she did not have any standing to sue because this was a Catholic school, and the Catholic schools came under the First Amendment protection of, you know, religious freedom. And so she lost. And, you know, this is true. You know, these voucher schools will be getting public dollars, and they can have 100% voucher students. In other words, every single kid at that school is receiving a taxpayer-funded voucher, but they still get to call themselves private. And because they are private, they get to operate by a completely different set of rules.
Yeah.
It's just not right. I mean, I don't care what you want to, how you want to describe it philosophically. I mean, even a kindergartner kid would say, this isn't fair.
Anything else, Ted? Ted's gone. I want to talk more about that pot of money. What kind of money is to be made in education?
Well, when you look at the public sector, you know, schools pretty much account for the overwhelming bulk of a lot of public money. You know, I think, well, let's put money into educating children and protecting the future. That, to me, is a good thing. But over the years, for example, since the voucher program was started, about $1.5 billion has been taken out of public education and funneled into private. In fact, last year alone, it was probably about $95 million, I think it was. No, actually, $155 million last year alone funneled out of public schools into the private voucher program. That's a lot of money.
So there are private companies that are...
Well, it's a little bit different. Here in Milwaukee, there's 112 voucher schools.
Mm-hmm.
Some are religious schools, and some indeed are just sort of, someone says,
let's have a school.
Exactly. Let's build a school. I went to school. I can do a school. I mean, for example, last year there was this Travis voucher school. They call them academies. It's amazing to me how people put the word academy behind the name of their school and they think somehow that makes it a great school. So you go all over, you go this Travis Academy. And, well, this Travis Academy, they had about 700 kids. They had some of the worst test scores in the state. 2%, only 2% of their students were proficient or better in math and reading. And this is what's amazing to me. So they were getting about $5 million from the state this year. And actually, since 1997, when the Travis Academy opened, they've gotten about $40 million. So last year, you know, Dorothy Travis, she heads the Travis Schools, and Alan Borsuk looked at the 990 because you're supposed to report to the federal government the income. Dorothy Travis, head of these Travis Schools, which were just an embarrassment, she was making $216,000. I mean, that's just a little bit below Gregory Thornton, who oversees all of the Milwaukee public schools and 80,000 students. And, you know, that's the other thing that really bothers me about the funneling into private schools. You know, in Wisconsin, if you want to, there's a database. You can find out the salary of every single public school employee in the state. So you can find out, what does Gregory Thornton make? What does my principal make? What does my, mm-hmm. you know, my daughter's third grade teacher make?
Mm-hmm.
And you can go, well, you know, interesting, important public information. Boy, getting public information out of the private schools is almost impossible. And not only is it almost impossible, but they are not required to follow open meetings and records. So, you know, back when I was at Rethinking Schools, I'd occasionally send letters and ask for racial breakdown or salary or test scores. And these private voucher schools would tell me in no uncertain terms, I don't even have to answer the phone when you call.
Mm. Ted, thanks very much for the call. Dave in Cobb is next. Hi, Dave.
Hello?
Yes, Dave. Hi.
Oh, good morning.
Hi.
What I'm concerned about, the regular taxpayer, I looked at my tax bill, which I just got done paying, and most of the tax bill that I had was toward the local school district. I'm thinking, okay, if they're going to start voucher systems, shouldn't that be a relief on the taxpayer? I'll have my answer out there.
All right, Dave, thanks.
Well, the whole tax thing is just, it's crazy, because here in Milwaukee, what happens is money for the voucher schools, about almost 40%, is taken directly out of the Milwaukee public schools. And so what do they have to do in order to sort of make up that money is increase taxes. And around the state, and people generally don't realize this, about 60% of the money for the voucher schools around the state, these are Milwaukee voucher schools, that comes out of the general funding from the state. So basically, you know, you might be up there in DePere or Superior or Rhinelander, you're paying for these Milwaukee voucher schools. Now, they're not advertising this fact, but that's what's happening.
Thank you very much, Dave, for the call. What about the general criticism, and we've heard a whole lot of this from many, many sources, that public schools have been failing, and they've particularly been failing minority students, Hispanic students, African-American students in cities all over this country, that teachers are not very good, that the unions are allowing them to stay in their professions when they should have left their professions a long time ago, that there is a better way to do all of this. So let's do voucher schools. Let's do experiment with charter schools to find out a better way to close the achievement gap, to deal with these, and you hear the phrase all the time, failing schools, Barbara.
Well, part of the thing is this term failing schools is kind of bandied about. And sometimes when you look beyond the rhetoric, they're not a failing school. I mean, one of the classic examples was when Mike Ellis, when he, this was last year during one of the discussions up in the legislature, they wanted to expand the voucher program to more states or more cities around the state. So Mike Ellis, he got caught on video. Thank God for YouTube sometimes. But anyhow, he's talking. He's saying, you know, well, we need to really kind of get these vouchers to Green Bay. And he said, you know, well, Green Bay East is fine and West is fine, but boy, Preble's a sewer. I mean, he called the school a sewer. And he did not have a clue what he was talking about, because about the same time the U.S. News and World Report comes out with its high school rankings. It's a national ranking. They rate the schools in every state around the country. Preble was considered, based on test scores, you know, just a whole range of factors that U.S. News and World Report looks into, Preble was deemed the fifth best school in the state. And ironically, and you know, and I'll admit, Milwaukee's got failing schools, but Milwaukee's got some great schools. For example, the U.S. News and World Report, the two best schools in the state of Wisconsin were in the Milwaukee public schools. Now, did you hear Walker ever praise those Milwaukee public schools? So part of the thing is, yeah, if you say something's a failure over and over and over and over enough, people might believe it. Just like if you tell a kid you're a failure, 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 failure long enough, they might believe it. But that doesn't mean they're a failure. That's rhetoric.
What's the difference, a caller wants to know, between voucher schools and charter schools? And are charter schools valuable for experimenting with a different way to teach our students?
Boy, now you're entering into the complicated world of vouchers, traditional charters. The easiest way, and because it is a long, complicated discussion, is the biggest difference is that voucher schools, by definition, are private schools. And as private schools, they do not have to follow the same rules. They don't have to hire certified teachers. In fact, until 2005, the voucher schools did not even have to hire someone with a high school graduation degree. they don't have to have open meetings and records, constitutional rights. I mean, just down the whole list of things, they do not have to follow the same rules. Charter schools are complicated because they are technically defined as public schools, but there's different types of charter schools. There's the district charter schools, and in most areas around the state, the school district. Basically, a charter is a contract to say, you know, we'll let you have, you know, this kind of leeway, and this is the contract, and this is what you get to do. And in fact, the charter movement started in the 1990s by progressive educators who said, we want to experiment, we want to innovate, and we want to use these lessons to improve the public schools. But what happened, and this is a national phenomenon, not just Milwaukee, but especially in some of the larger urban areas like New York, charters also became sort of the darling of the hedge fund managers and people who wanted
really?
To. Oh, yeah. Oh, if you look at the boards of directors and the who's behind the charter movement in New York City, it's these hedge fund managers. It's and that's a lot of different reasons. Some of it's geography, because Manhattan's got some really nice real estate. But anyhow, you know, for example, here in Milwaukee, we have a growing number of charter schools that they're publicly in definition, but they're privately run. They have a private board of directors. They are run by private entrepreneurs, and lots of times not even from the city. I mean, the biggest growth spurt in Milwaukee in the charter schools is this rocket ship group out of California, started by a Silicon Valley entrepreneur. They're coming to Milwaukee. They want to run 8 schools. And I looked at, they have this like 500-page application to the Milwaukee Common Council, and I looked at it, and it was fascinating. And I wonder if any of the alder people read the entire 500 pages, because it says very clearly, several times in that application, that off the top, 20% of the school's operating budget will go to, quote-unquote, management fees back to Rocket Ship in California. And I'm going, oh, this is pretty slick. I mean, it's just crazy. And to top it off, they don't even offer art and music classes in their school in California. They sort of have these computer cubicles, sort of Dilbert-like computer cubicles. And because they put these kids in front of these computers for 2 hours a day, they save money. But they don't have art or music. They don't use that money to enrich the school curriculum. It's like a dumbed-down curriculum for poor kids. And I think that's wrong.
Let's go to Pat in Neenah. Hi, Pat.
Hello?
Hi, Pat. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wanting to say that, you know, the whole voucher system and everything, it's all part of a larger movement whereby they cut taxes, and that causes things to be underfunded and dysfunctional. And then they move to privatize in order to kick more profits to their corporate owners. And this is really, I would say, almost 90% a Republican problem.
It really is. I mean, it's at the, I mean, I think, what can I say? You've said that very succinctly. And it is true. The voucher movement is clearly part of a broader Republican agenda and strategy. And it's not coincidental that the two times when the voucher movement made significant gains, actually the three times when you include Walker, it's when the Republicans controlled the entire state government, both the gubernatorial and the legislature. And bit by bit, but surely, as much as the sun rises every morning, they advanced their program whenever they saw they could.
Thanks very much for the call, Pat. Let's go to Dwayne in Onalaska. Hi, Dwayne.
Hi there. I have a question and a comment. My question is, okay, considering all the communities in the entire United States, why did voucher schools become so popular in Milwaukee, of all places? That's my question. And then my comment is kind of beating the odds of what you spoke about a while ago, how the public schools in the state of Wisconsin are not in good shape. I can actually, a success story, Onalaska Public School District is doing very well and is very strong. That's my comment.
You know, and Onalaska's not alone that way, because there's a lot of schools that are doing great. And even in a district that may not be doing great, there's a lot of good schools. And even in a district that is seen as one of the best in the state, you know, there's still gaps in the achievement between blacks and whites. I mean, education's very complicated. And interestingly, when you look at so many of the different studies on what are some of the factors involved in quote-unquote academic achievement and test scores, you know, there's what people call the Volvo effect. And someone said that to me once, and I said, the Volvo effect? What are you talking about? And they said, well, you drive into a neighborhood and you see how many Volvos are parked in the driveway. And you got a lot of Volvos, you got a lot of BMWs, I guarantee you they're going to have good test scores.
And good, yeah. Thank you very much, Duane, for your call. I have a fundamental question with all of this. It seems as though in order for a state to succeed, a country to succeed, I'm stating the obvious here, but it seems as though people may be overlooking the obvious, you have to have students who like to learn. You have to have conversations between politicians and businesses and universities. You have to make sure that schools are thriving. You can't. It seems like you're taking a huge risk to dismantle what has been a pillar of American democracy for a long, long time, Barbara, and take a chance with something that may not work as well. Doesn't that serve to everybody's detriment? Aren't there a lot of people who might be concerned about that?
I think there's a ton of people concerned, but they don't really quite know what's going on because of all the rhetoric around vouchers. It's promoted as choice, and well, choice is as an American as apple pie. And they don't talk about that. No, what's really going on here is the abandonment of public education. And these are complicated questions. I mean, there's no doubt that there's turmoil in this country, that there are those who want to return to what they view as this idyllic world of the 1950s. Wasn't idyllic for everyone. There was Jim Crow. Women were by and large stuck in the kitchen. And if you said that you were gay or lesbian, you were probably hounded out of town. But there's tension, and it's disturbing to me. I don't think this is unrelated to the incredible and growing income gap in this country. And I think there's a growing number of people who think, well, if they can get their money and get their sort of gated community and get their local school that keeps out the poor kids, well, then they'll be all right. But, you know, whether you look at that on religious grounds, you know, every man is my brother, no man is an island, or on grounds of democracy where, you know, nominally, in the face of the law, we are all equal, I think it's sad, and it won't work. I mean, that's that. I'm thinking, you know, I look at Milwaukee and I go, oh, my God, we have lost 20 years of trying to work together to improve our public schools. We are 20 years behind, and things are worse than they were 20 years ago. And I don't want that to happen to the state. And, you know, vouchers are coming across the state. And the only thing that will keep vouchers from expanding in this state is if the people in Onalaska, in Green Bay, in Superior, and say, hey, we don't want to destroy our public schools. Say no to this, because there's a lot more sensitivity outside of Milwaukee among those Republican legislators about people support their public schools. They like their public schools. They like their kids' third grade teacher.
Barbara Miner is our guest this hour. Her book, which has just been published, is Lessons from the Heartland, A Turbulent Half-Century of Public Education in an Iconic American City. It's a city that she's been living in for a long time, sent her children to Milwaukee Public Schools, and she has been analyzing education issues for a long time. She's going to be at Boswell Books, we should say, Friday, January 25 at 7 o'clock, a talk and signing at Boswell Books. Well, she will weave together the history of public education in Milwaukee with a look at what's happening now, and this is a chance for redemption in the 21st century. Is there a chance for redemption?
I hope so. I hope
we'll
so.
Find out as we continue our conversation and take more of your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to a couple more phone calls. Helen in Middleton, hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
This is a great show. I'm so glad I have time to talk. I want to know if the charter schools have to follow the same standards for all that testing that they do. I taught school forever in Middleton, Madison. I started 50 years ago, and all those schools were wonderful schools. Even when I was in country school, we had to take us to go to the next grade, and that really was true.
So I
need to know about the testing.
Yes, and it varies a little bit. Charter schools, by and large, have to follow many of the same standards, and they do take the WKCE, which is the fancy name for the Wisconsin tests that are given to all public school students. There are some differences, though. For example, they do not have to be certified in the subject matter they are teaching. They have a different type of certification that's allowed in charter schools. And there's some other areas where they don't have to follow the same requirements as public schools. You know, one of my big concerns is these privately run charter schools where there's not a venue for the public to really find out what's going on at the school. And that, you know, that's, you know, one of the things about the 2012 elections, people became very aware of the attempt to disenfranchise people and take away the vote. And they responded by increasingly their vote. But another way to sort of subvert democracy and sort of take the life out of democracy is to take public institutions out of public oversight. And that's what bothers me about a lot of these moves of things that are public institutions, but suddenly they're not subject to the same public oversight. Because then you're not really following either the spirit or the letter of democracy.
Thank you, Helen, for the call. Chris is next in Saratoga. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I just want to say I was against the school voucher system from its inception. I've seen through its ruse of helping poor kids, and I couldn't agree with your guest more that this is a larger problem. It is a war on the poor, where we used to have a war on poverty, and there's a element in this country that is attacking that helps poor people through institutions and programs, and I'd like to see more Americans become more cynical about solutions and reforms.
You're very articulate. The war on poverty became a war against the poor. Boys, is that unfortunately true?
You have something you want to read. Do you want to set it up for us?
Sure. This is in the book. You know, I deal a lot with policy, but boy, you know, policy wonk articles, after a while, my eyes glaze over. So I tried to tell some different stories. And one of the nice things about researching for the book was I got to research my family because I grew up in Milwaukee. And, you know, classic Catholic, Irish Catholic family. You know, we had six kids and my mother's aunt here and there. And anyhow, I had a cousin, Rosemary, from the South Side. And I was talking to her about it, and she said, oh, my gosh, the 1960s Milwaukee. Boy, have I got some stories for you. And anyhow, this is a story she told me about Father Grappi, who was the civil rights leader, led the open housing marches, very controversial in the Catholic community. So I'll read from this because it gives a little bit of a flavor of the book. And forgive me if I stumble here or there. I'm not a teacher. I like my computer.
You're doing fine.
Anyhow. So Rosemary was a year younger than me and the only child of my mother's sister, Aunt Rose. She remembers exactly when she first met Father Grappi. It was 1960, when she was a third grader at St. Veronica's on Milwaukee's South Side. At the time, the newly ordained Father Grappi was the assistant priest at St. Veronica's, and he oversaw religious education. About once a week, he'd come to talk to the students. Rosemary sat in the front row, and Grappi had a habit of casually perching himself on the edge of her desk as he addressed the class. He always called me my angel, Rosemary fondly recalls. Grappi didn't drill the children about the catechism or preach about mortal sin, but instead he talked about how to treat each other. He had a gentle manner and a soft voice, so the class had to listen hard. And they did. He always told us to treat people with respect. That's one of the things I remember most, Rosemary calls. He was an amazingly effective teacher. Over the next few years, Grappi grew increasingly influential with St. Veronica's school children. He became a Milwaukee version of the charismatic young priest so effectively portrayed by Bing Crosby in The Bells of St. Mary's. When Grappi left in 1963 to take up the new post he had sought, at St. Boniface's in the central city, Rosemary was confused. I couldn't figure out why he'd want to leave St. Veronica's, she remembers. It was such a great school, and of course I was completely unaware of what was going on elsewhere in Milwaukee, but I really missed him when he left. It would be 2 years before Rosemary again saw Grappi face to face, and under far different circumstances. It was in 1965 when issues overlapped as the civil rights movement segued from focusing on desegregation to discrimination at the Eagles Club. Rosemary's father, Milan Potter, was both on the Milwaukee School Board and manager of the Eagles Club. He was in the crosshairs of both issues. The evening started out like many a Friday night. Rosemary and her parents were heading out for a fish fry. While driving to dinner, Rosemary's father turned on the radio. The news reported that 200 Negroes were picketing the home of Milan Potter. My father spun around the car and my mother became very, very upset, Rosemary recalls. This was 1965 when stereotypes were strong. My mother started worrying that her house could be looted. Rosemary laughs as she recalls how her dad tried to make light of the matter. He looks at my mother and says, Rose, maybe we should invite them all in for coffee. Before long, they arrived back home, pulling up in front. There were all these people, Rosemary remembers, and I was thinking, how are we going to get to the door? And then I got out, and the first person I see is Father Grappi. He raises his arm in welcome and yells out, Rosemary, Angel! I run to him because I love him. He was my parish priest, and I hug him. The next thing Rosemary remembers, her father grabbed her by the coat collar and yanked her away, telling her to get into the house immediately. Sheriff's deputies on the scene directed the family into the basement, worried that matters could perhaps turn violent, because whites from the neighborhood were forming a counter-picket. After a while, the family was allowed to go back upstairs. Rosemary's father and mother went into the living room while Rosemary ran to the den with its large picture window. She looked outside and saw her neighbors picketing the picketers. Father Grappi was in the midst of it all. All she could think about was how much she wanted to be with her parish priest. And I remember asking my dad, why can't I go outside? It's Father Grappi. He's my friend. I loved and trusted my father, she continues, but I loved Father Grappi and trusted him as well. Rosemary's father insisted she stay inside. She didn't openly challenge that decision, but a threshold was crossed. In that moment, I knew that issues were not black and white, and there were many shades of gray, she says. I realized the world was far more complicated than I had been taught, and that I could no longer blindly listen to what my father had to say.
That is quite a story. And she thought long and hard about how we treat each other, didn't she?
Oh, you know, the 60s lingers on in a lot of people, just as I firmly believe the Madison Uprising will live in the many, many young children and young families that were up there protesting.
And how does it live in those people now?
The 1960s?
Protesters. No, the Madison protesters.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I have families, boy, spread all across the state. And I think in particular of my nephew, my godson, Dana, and his wife, Jenny, and their two young children, Mira and Soren. They're like, 6 and 9 right now. And Dana worked for the university hospitals. Not in schools, but because he was a university employee and was affected by Walker's attacks on the public sector. He thought, oh my gosh, you know, he moved back to Madison from Arizona. He wanted to be in Madison. He wanted to be in Wisconsin. And he thought, wow, I might have to look elsewhere for a job to support my family. Anyhow, so they were up at Madison, up at the protests. And, you know, like I say, Mira was 5, 6, Soren was 8, 9. And then my sister, one day, my sister Mimi, she says, and there's Mira singing the song, I Once Was a Union Maid. And I just laughed aloud. And I'm thinking, wow, here's this sick old. She might, you know, she's getting her music lessons up there at the Capitol. And, you know, kids don't forget those things. They just don't forget.
Yeah. Barbara, thank you ever so much. And at least you have your eyes and ears on the history of all of this. You'll be Friday, January 25 at Boswell Books.
Correct.
Signing the books. Side.
Oh, yeah. And a good time will be had by all. It'll be a chance to talk about things. Not just me, but, boy, you know, community people, teachers, parents. Just
right.
Y'all come.
Right. It's time for the conversation. It's time for a lot of conversations about this issue. Her book is Lessons from the Heartland, A Turbulent Half Century of Public Education in an Iconic American City. We thank her so much for her work. Thanks, Barbara.
Oh, and thank you, Kathleen.
And thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. I want to tell you about, if I can find the right sheet of paper here. Where is it? The inaugural activities that we are going to be. Oh, here it is. It's just right over here. Monday night at 6 on the Ideas Network, special coverage of Inauguration Day from NPR News. It will be Monday night at 6, the president's address to the nation, all the pomp that accompanies this historic event, the swearing-in ceremony. I just want to let you know that that's going to be on Monday. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. Thanks for all of your calls and for your interest and for caring about other people. Be with you again in a while. This is the Ideas Network.